Hello, and welcome to the third night of Millennial 2020. I have four interviews this evening, as usual. But the first one is perhaps the most illustrious guest, and it is Godfrey Bloom, the former UKIP MEP and businessman and all-round libertarian, would you say?
And I would say.
Yeah. Okay. So, excellent. Well, we're going to talk about several things, but first, thank you very much for agreeing to appear on this. It's an interview that I've wanted to do for a long time, and I think it should be a very interesting conversation. So, Mr. Bloom, what would you say? Let's start with talking about the European Union, because I think that's a key in all of this, in this age, that the EU is a key thing for Britain. And perhaps it should never have been, but it is. So what would you say the European Union began as, and what did it become? And was it always supposed to become that thing?
Well, that's a very interesting question indeed, because in this country, in the United Kingdom, everybody is under the impression that it was a trade agreement and a trade arrangement. Because what we did, what we were asked to join in 1972, was the common market. We believed it was a common market. And as a free trader, I believed that a common market with no barriers to trade was a very good thing. So consequently, in 1975, when we were asked to endorse it in a referendum, I voted for it. Now, that was rather because I was a young man. I was probably about 24, 25 years old. My main interests in life were crumpet, rugby and beer. And in that order, it's reverse order now. It's just beer, sadly. But I didn't look into it too deeply. Now, Enoch Powell warned us what it was and what it has always been. It is a deeply held political ideal in Europe for a united Europe, a centralized united Europe, in much the same way as the United States is today. Not even a federation, not federal, a state, a central superstate. And that's what it has always been. And even today, what is fascinating is how few people in this country understand it. Most mainstream media commentators and interviewers on TV don't understand it. They only ever talk about trade. This has got nothing whatsoever to do with trade. And whenever I speak at universities, and I speak at a lot, I try and persuade the undergraduates to understand it isn't about trade. It's about a European ideal, which may be noble or it may be ignoble. You know, it depends on your point of view. There's certainly nothing wrong with that if that's what you believe in. But of course, the powers that be knew they couldn't sell that to the British people. So they sold it on trade and how much better off we'd be economically. And that's going on today. Nobody voted at the referendum for a deal. We voted for Brexit. We voted to leave. And we endorse that again at a general election with Theresa May and again in October of last year. And so the British people have spoken three times. Three times they have said without hesitation or categorization, can we please leave the European Union lock, stock and barrel? And of course, the civil service want to keep us in. It is holy writ. I've had enough experience to know and met enough very senior civil servants who believe too deeply with religious fervour that our future is in a centralised Europe. All the House of Parliament want it. The House of Commons are in the majority of remaining. The House of Lords are almost 90% remain. So you have on the one hand the establishment wanting to remain and the ordinary British people wanting to leave. So that's how it is. And it took me, it didn't take me long when I worked in the belly of the beast in Brussels to realize that you're dealing with Euro fanatics. This has got nothing. Look what the situation is today, if you will. We are the biggest customer of the European Union. The trade imbalance is 80-20. We buy all their cars. We buy 18% of French wine. So we buy all this stuff and still they're prevaricating on a deal. The deal could have been done, a trade deal could have been done in an afternoon. An afternoon. So what we're dealing with now is complete nonsense.
The interesting thing about it interests me that it was sold to the British public in the first place as a trade a trading organization, a trading cartel, I don't know what the word would be, a common market. Because I think that it's actually, that's a very sort of pragmatic, practical concern, trade, the economy and commerce. And it appeals to, I would say it appeals to something in the British psyche. Whereas the actual people in the European Union seem to be very romantic and idealistic and ideological about the project. I mean, for them, I don't think it is so. Well, what would you say about that?
Yes, I'd agree for a lot of people in the European Union, because they have had two catastrophic world wars. Catastrophic for us, too, incidentally. But we didn't have the Wehrmacht marching down Pall Mall, goose-stepping down Pall Mall like the French did. The situation is rather different with us. We haven't been invaded for 1,000 years. So we don't think like Europeans. We're an island nation. We don't think like them. That doesn't mean to say we're anti-European. I have lots of French friends and German friends, and I enjoy Italian opera, so on and so forth. Nobody's anti-European, but I don't want a superstate, and I don't want to be a province of a superstate, which, of course, as we all know, is a German horse ridden by a French jockey. And that's now that has been the case now for some time. But what is interesting, of course, it's beginning to turn into who pays the piper calls the shots. So this is becoming a very much more German orientated thing now, a much more German dominated thing, which is rather ironic, given my father was a fighter pilot in the war. My grandfather was injured on the Messines Ridge in 1917. Whoops-a-daisy, how did we end up here?
Well, it certainly is ironic, because I think that, from my own experience of the German people of today, they're very self-hating, and they don't think in those expansionist terms at all. And it does seem to be something that's sort of just happened almost by accident, that they find themselves at the heart of this this federation or this empire of the EU, and I wonder if it's it almost seems more French to me in its mentality and its conception. It's very romantic, very idealistic, but of course it does rely on German financing and infrastructure, logistics. I would say, do you think that the EU, the European Union, the common market, do you think that it could have worked without the British? I mean, do you think that it was always, do you think that it could ever have worked, basically?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Certainly, I think it would have had a better chance. But there's two problems here. There's the British, who are a maritime island nation, as Churchill said, who tend to look to the open sea, the Commonwealth, Australia, the Dominions, Canada, even the Indian subcontinent, to which I'm a frequent visitor. So we don't think like the French. We've never thought like the French, which is why they're French and we're not. They have never liked the laissez-faire capitalistic approach to the City of London. And I'm not just going back to post-war. I'm going back to Napoleonic times. I mean, Napoleon said, what a city to sack. The French ethos, broadly, is protectionist. You've got the word right just a little while ago, just there. You said that the European Union is a cartel. It's a protectionist cartel. It isn't a free, it's a very enclosed free trade zone. And it's based on tariffs from imports from outside Europe. And it's based on quotas, which is why you can't find South African white wine in the shops. The quotas are picked up by the Germans. It's why some of the good Chilean, Argentinian wines are more expensive than they need to be. It's all these things are about protectionism, and it's what the French have always liked, about protecting French farmers, French business, so on and so forth. Now, the French think that's perfectly legitimate, and I'm not saying it's not legitimate, but it isn't the English way or the British way. We are traders. We are global traders, and we have been, of course, for many, many years. Now, there's a new dynamic, to help answer your question, if I can, which is a difficult one. There's a new dimension, and that is Eastern Europe. Now, Eastern Europeans, and my wife is half Polish, and I lecture in Eastern Europe and Poland and places like this. It's a different kettle of fish there. They've just come out of the Soviet Union. very recently, historically, by historical standards, extremely recently, in very easy living memory. And what they say to me when I'm lecturing, say, at the Warsaw School of Economics, for example, or wherever I may be in Eastern Europe, they say, this is beginning to look very much like something we've only just got to escape from. And you'll find that view expressed in Hungary, in Budapest, in Warsaw, in the Czech Republic. They're saying, my goodness me, this isn't quite what we thought it was. And of course, the British now, as Enoch Powell said would happen, is we're all saying, which is why we won the referendum, was, my goodness me, this isn't what we thought it was. It isn't what I thought it was. More fool me. Well, I was a young man and I voted for it, and we all make mistakes. But as soon as I saw what it was, which didn't take very long, I set off on the Brexit trail, which I've been on for nearly 30 years. So I think the European Union is doomed because it is a protectionist cartel. And it's also doomed not because we're going, it's because I think Eastern European countries are beginning to recognize it for what it is. And I think sooner or later it will break up. And some people think it might go back to something like the Hanseatic League, for example, of northern states, where Holland and Switzerland and Denmark and Germany have a lot more in common in many, many ways than the Greeks and the Italians and the Portuguese, all lumped together with the same currency and the same rates of interest. This is doomed failure. It doesn't matter if we're leaving, but it doesn't really matter whether we'd stayed or not. It's doomed to failure. It'll all be over in a few years, as all empires do. Even ours, which was much more efficiently run and democratically run, the British Empire came to an end, and the Roman even more so. The Roman Empire lasts for hundreds of years, but all empires come to an end, and this is coming to an end in front of our very eyes.
Yeah. Well, perhaps because it inspired much less love. It's difficult to love the European. I guess that you said that the people inside it are fanatical about it, but I think that ordinary people just don't identify. Well, okay, there are some. I mean, you see the FBPE people on Twitter who are obsessed with it. But I think the general public just don't feel any attachment to the European Union. And it's like a sort of labyrinthine puzzle to them, how it actually works. No one really understands it. One last thing about the trade thing is, and I remember reading, I started getting into this in the late 2000s, and I was reading people like Douglas Murray back then and James Dellingpole. And I remember there was a point, and Daniel Hannan at the time, and I remember there was a point made by one of them that the British were tricked into joining the EU, the common market, on the basis that it would be good for us economically. And this writer said, and again, I don't know whether this is true or not, perhaps you will know, he said that it was good for us economically for 1 year. And then thereafter, every single year, we've put more money into the EU than we got back out of it. Do you have any knowledge on this topic?
Oh, yes. I mean, economic research is my field. There's no question about it. That prices went up, food prices went up, because it's a cartel. Even today, you can buy wine, you could buy cheaper wine from the New World, cheaper clothes, cheaper leather goods from outside. It's the cartel that makes it more expensive. So there's no question about that at all. That's just a matter of plain fact. And of course, you can find Enoch Powell on a clip. I'm not quite sure when it was. I think he was speaking about 1980, when Enoch Powell actually went through a list, it's still on YouTube, of exactly what became more expensive. I think dairy products, for example, butter and things like that, and cheese, went up something like 150% in 2 or 3 years. So the thing has been an economic disaster, and of course fishing is a disaster. But of course, Edward Heath wanted to join. He took us in, and he was a Federalist at the time with religious fervor. And much later on, he was interviewed on television when he was quite old. He was, nearly 80 or something. He said, had I put the truth to the British people, had I said what it really was and what the goal of the European Union was, nobody would have voted for it. So we had to tell them. And if you go back to Schuman and you go back to the founders, they say, we must not tell the people the truth about this. It has to be done. And this is on record. This isn't me having some sort of flight of fancy here. It's easily, you can look it up in the book of quotations, if you will. We must go very steadily. We mustn't tell the people the truth. We mustn't frighten the horses. We must tell them it's about trade, travel. Our children go to foreign universities if they want to, and they can go backpacking, all that kind of. Keep it really simple, but it's nothing like that at all. It is nothing like that at all. And that's beginning to come to the fore.
Do you think that the real goal was the dissolution of European countries?
Oh, without question. Nationalism, and they feel that there's a fear of nationalism in Europe because of the wars. And it's not just the First and Second War. The Franco-Prussian Wars, it's the Austro-Prussian Wars. You've only got to, and sadly, of course, we have a generation, maybe two generations now, haven't had the benefit of a traditional education. Certainly nobody on mainstream media, to my knowledge, has had the benefit of a traditional education. I don't mean they've got some sort of piece of paper stamped at Oxford or Cambridge or Durham or something. They've got a stamp on it, but they're not educated people. I know, I lecture there. I meet the dons and all the rest of it. They're men of very, very shallow intellect, paradoxically. So they don't know about these things. But this has been a drive. And of course, it's a drive. Napoleon wanted this. Hitler wanted this. They wanted a centralized Europe. But of course, the French wanted it under French control. The Germans wanted it under German control. But the principles are just the same as we're fighting now. That's how it is. And it's obvious for anybody who wants to see it. But of course, people don't want to see it. There's none so blind as those that don't want to see.
Oh, indeed. One last question about the EU. You've said that it's a protectionist cartel. Other people say that it's the start of a sort of globalism. It's the start of a one world government. What would you say about that? Because, I mean, there have been moves to bring in Northern Africa into it and so on.
Well, we go back, don't we, to the cock-up or the conspiracy theory. And having been in politics only 10 years, I mean, I'm an investment banker really by profession. So it's very difficult for me to actually judge. And it depends what day you get me. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and think it's a cock up. And sometimes I think it's a conspiracy. And it's only when you've been in elected politics for 10 years and you know these people. And I know these people. I know lots of them. I've had drinks with them. I've had dinner with them. I've had lunches with them. Conversations, debates with them at universities. They are incredibly stupid. You have no idea until you're actually in the game just how stupid they are. So the thought that they're actually conspiring is difficult because they can barely conspire to cross the road. They're that stupid. But of course, who's pulling the strings? Now, where it is, of course, certainly the civil service are conspiring. We know that. And the civil service, of course, individually are significantly more intelligent than the politician. You've only got to look back to Yes Minister to see a wonderful portrayal of that. Then look and see who wants it. So the civil service want it. The great and the good want it because it's gravy and they love gravy. And the House of Lords these days is about gravy. Who else wants it? Who's sinister? Well, let's have a little think. The CIA want it. And the CIA have wanted a federal Europe or a European state now since the war, since 1945. And they still do. This is a very heavily CIA-driven ideal. And, of course, now we're seeing the World Economic Forum, people getting together at Davos, Doha, all these places, the great and the good, the wealthy, the super wealthy. You know, the Bill Gates of this world, the George Soroses of this world. These people are rich. You know, you've got to go back to almost Rockefeller to find people that rich by comparison today. And they're not socialists or communists, which people sometimes make the mistake of suggesting they are. They're technocrats, and they are deeply hostile to democracy. And they take the view, and it's not an unreasonable view, I have to say, that Hans Hopper takes, the death of the god democracy, that democracy is doomed to fail. And therefore, we need very rich and very clever people running it for the little people. That's what that is their core belief. This was the belief, of course, of Prussia under the Kaiser in the turn of the century, 1900s, was that you give people a certain amount of social security, you try and look after a little bit of pensions, but you can't have democracy. But then you have to just fast back to what democracy is which is what we don't have today, if you look at the Athenian concept of democracy, it was that those got to vote, or those had a say in government, who had skin in the game, as our American friends would say, which I think is a magnificent phrase, skin in the game. Now you get a vote in the United Kingdom and America and Europe. If you attain the age of 18, you get a vote. It matters not what you contribute to society or what you know or who you are. So it's doomed. And these people are manipulated, which is why we now see, as we walk around our towns, most of people walking around with great muzzles on their faces, under the impression that somehow that is going to stop them getting this bug, which, of course, is ludicrous. But they believe it because they believe anything they're told by the state, that we've built a generation that believes what they're told by civil servants and politicians. They believe it to be true. It's only people who sit down and do some research about these matters who understand what's going on. But your man in the street now is living a quiet level, a sort of a life of quiet desperation. He's not interested in trying to find out whether masks work or not, or what the real mortality statistics are of COVID, or any of these things. He's not interested. He just wants to get about his business in the best way that he can. And consequently, that makes it very easy for him to be manipulated by people who are very clever, who do have an agenda. But whether it's Boris, who's frankly a buffoon, Hancock is a lunatic sociopath. No, it's not these people. We don't know who's pulling the strings.
Well, I guess if they were any good at pulling the strings, they would make sure that nobody knew who they were.
Exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, it does surprise me about the civil service, because you obviously, yes, Minister, indeed, you would think that they would want to maximise their own control. But what they actually seem to want to do is give away their control, their power, to supranational entities. It is difficult. It's difficult to fathom. Well, what is the driving force then? And as you say, it does seem to be billionaire technocrats like Bill Gates. I mean, he's obsessed with the vaccine. He's obsessed with being this. You might think it's a savior complex, although I don't think it is. I think he's more. It's more vanity for him. It's difficult. You can only guess, really. But it's. About democracy, what would you say about that? Do you think that democracy, and this is a huge question to ask you, do you think that democracy is doomed? I mean, do you think that the technocrats are actually correct? Or do you think that we could save it if there was a higher quality of voter?
Two questions there, really. First of all, the civil service. I'll answer that one, because it's a very good question. I didn't know either. It didn't make any sense to me. Why you would want to devolve power somewhere else. It isn't a natural thing to do. And it takes a bit of thinking about it. And it took me many years in the European Parliament and many years of working with civil servants, to understand it. But if you are a bureaucrat by training, and our training, our bureaucrats are nearly all Oxford. And in France, there's a much more professional approach to becoming a senior bureaucrat, which is why they're much better than us, much cleverer than us, much better at negotiating than us. We're not very good. We're mainly chaps who play cricket, who went to minor public schools and all that's jolly good stuff, you know. But it means that the French run ring round all the time. But if you believe in a bureaucratic state, which civil servants do, it's natural for them to go that route in the same way. You might look at the militaristic route in Prussia in the late 1890s, which was a militaristic society. If you're a soldier, you think the best way forward is with a militaristic society. If you're a bureaucrat, you think the best way forward is a bureaucratic society. And that's why they're in favor of it. And they're still going to get their massive pensions, index linked, very considerable salaries. They're going to get their knighthoods, their CBEs, and then they're going to sit on a board somewhere in the city after that, just like, yes, Minister, it suits them. No civil servant is going to go to the barricade the way things are. They're doing very nicely feathering their own nest. So that's the situation. Now, is democracy doomed? I think every political system is doomed. I don't care whether it's Marxism, communism, socialism, fascism, democracy, if you will, it is doomed because it becomes decadent. and it becomes corrupt. And what we have now, the problem we have decadence and we have corruption. And I mean intellectual corruption. We have fiscal corruption as well. Of course we do. It's there for all to see. We have intellectual corruption. So it means in a representative democracy, your MP has been got there by a small committee of people. Hardly anybody belongs to a political party. It's so small, membership of political parties in the United Kingdom, it's immeasurable. It's too small to measure. It's just a few hundreds out of millions of us. So consequently, they get to Parliament, the 650 of them, then who actually ends up in the cabinet? Maybe 30 or 40 in various positions. So it's whittled down again. So consequently, we're not getting representative democracy. We're not getting any kind of democracy at all in the real historical way of understanding it. So is it doomed? I would argue my best answer would be the sort of democracy we have at the moment is doomed. Yes, it's doomed. And we've already proven that. We're locked down in our houses. We can't come out. We're told who can come to see us on Christmas Day. Our pubs are closed. Our restaurants are closed. It's already failed. Goodness me, what more needs to happen? Democracy has already failed. Our constitution has protected us. The principles of English law. We should be protected by the 1688 Bill of Rights, which has never been rescinded, but I'm afraid that hasn't helped us. We have a politicized police force, which is now not worthy of the name. It's nowhere near what Robert Peel decided it should be, policing by consent. We've just now in the main got thugs in uniform, and they're morons, most of them. They're morons. I mean, speak to the average local cop. I say that I've got a local cop here in my village who's a really, really top dude. He's a really nice guy and he's bright. But he's not reflective of the modern. I mean, look at the Met. I mean, the Met police. Dear, oh dear. And of course, they're led by morons as well. So consequently, we have a politicized police force. We have a politicized civil service, which is a relatively new concept. And, you know, that comes with really post-Blair. So consequently, is democracy doomed? Democracy, as we understand it today, is certainly doomed. And good riddance to it.
Well, one thing that I'd like to ask about regarding democracy, your thoughts on this. It seems to me that a fascinating thing about the Brexit referendum is that it breached party lines. So you'd get people who would be very much tied to the Labour Party, but they voted against the Labour Party's line. They voted to leave the EU. That seemed to me very unique. Because, well, we very rarely have referendums or referenda in Britain, and so but it was a genuine. It was actually the voice of the people. And if you think that's what democracy should be about, then that the Brexit referendum was much closer to that than one in which the voice of the people is sort of shone through the prism of the political parties. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I learned a lot when I was, funny enough, in the army, because it put me in cheek by jowl. I was promoted from the ranks, so I saw lots of it from the inside. And I was commanding a territorial squadron through the miners' strike in the 1980s in Doncaster. And I was working for an investment bank at the time when I came back to command this squadron. And this very day, I got Christmas cards from the people in the sergeant's mess who were miners who were striking. This is going back to what we were saying privately earlier about leadership. You know, you lead by example and force of personality, not by telling people what to do. So I always knew that if you scrape the surface of your average old Labour supporter, you've got a patriot. I mean, I went into houses of my soldiers and my NCOs, and you find a picture of the Queen on the wall. You know, these people are patriotic. So it transcends party politics. It transcends Labour and it transcends Conservative and all that sort of nonsense. It transcends all that. So they are patriotic. That's point number one. And they believe in self-government. They might believe that it should be better run by Labour, old Labour, incidentally, not modern Labour, which has nothing to do with the working class man now. And of course, who voted Leave? It was the artisan class. It was your butcher, your sparky, your chippy, your bricky. They're the people who voted Leave because they are either self-employed or in small companies. And they saw the damage all the regulation was spewing out of Brussels, the damage it was doing for them. And that was one of the reasons. Now, if you work in the public sector, and let me just explain this, but I suspect anybody watching this clip will already know this. They say, oh, the divide was somehow between old people and young people in Leave and Remain. That is absolutely ludicrous. That was not the divide. The divide, and I can tell you this without fear of contradiction by anybody who's looked at the numbers and taken any trouble to look at it. The divide was people in the public sector and people in the private sector. And I don't mean private sector. I don't mean FTSE companies. I don't mean big business. And of course, 80% of our economy is small businesses and self-employed. And this is really what it's all about. If you work for the town hall, if you are a bureaucrat, you voted to stay. You voted remain because it's nice, easy work if you can get it. If you're slogging it out, getting up at 6 a.m. to lay bricks or be a chippy or be a sparky, and a wealth creator, and make no mistake here, it doesn't matter how small you are, you're a wealth creator if you're not in the public sector. And that's how it works. And they voted Leave. So yes, it cut across party political lines as it was bound to do. And I must quote here, if I must quote Nigel Farage, because he came up with a couple of brilliant quotes, which I've always loved. One was when he was campaigning, the longer the drive, the more stupid the occupant, which I loved. And the other one he came out with, and I know because I live in a small rural community in the East Riding of Yorkshire, never underestimate the stupidity of a rural conservative.
Oh, well, what was he getting at there? Are rural conservatives known? I mean, see, there is a cliche of the rural conservative being the equivalent of the redneck in America. Is that what he was getting at?
I think he was getting at the fact that, and it's quite true, Let's take Malton, for example, which is a big city up the road, a big town up the road. Now, I have a Jack Russell bitch with more brains than the guy who won that seat. It's one of the safest conservative seats in the country. The guy is a complete and utter cretin. His name is Kevin Hollingrake. Moreover, he's a socialist. But the reason he got elected, because he had a big, big blue rosette on his extremely bovine chest. And right, the country's covered with these kind of morons. So that is the point Nigel was making. And you would think the Conservatives are supposed to be the patriotic party. They're the patriotic party. But of course, your average rural Conservative is still under the impression that the Conservative Party is the same as it was under Lord Salisbury in the 1850s.
Yes.
That it was a liberal with a small L. It was liberal. It was a laissez-faire administration. And of course, Lord Salisbury's was the most successful administration in the history of the Conservative Party. Now the Conservative Party tell us what to eat, what to think. The Conservative Party are well to the left of Blair's Labour Party, and they swung to the left under Major and carried on turning left. Now the national debt is the highest in our history. The Conservative Party has over doubled it in the last 10 years, the Conservative Party. So we are now dealing with a socialist administration of astonishing proportion, and that's what they are. But the rural Conservative, mark my words, will continue to vote for the Conservatives. And I once spoke to one of them when I was campaigning years ago for UKIP. And I said, you know, I get the pressure after the conversation. If the chairman of the Conservative Party and his cronies came in, shot your dog, raped your daughter and killed your wife, you'd still vote Conservative, wouldn't you? And he looked at me and said, well, I suppose I probably would. Where could he go with that? At least he was honest, man, wasn't he?
Yeah. And I now see what Nigel Farage was getting at. It's this naivety among the Conservatives. I do think that there is a certain lack of imagination among Conservatives compared to Liberals. And, you know, and I don't like saying that, but I think, you know, just empirically, it seems to be the case. And one effect of this lack of imagination is that they can't see what's right in front of them because it's so ridiculous, but it is the truth. They can't see that the Conservative Party is not conservative. It's called conservative. And it comes from this, you know, legacy, this history of conservatism, but it's not conservative. It doesn't conserve anything. That came up in a previous stream a few nights ago, that it's difficult to... I was talking to the Traditional Britain group last night, and I asked them, when was the last time the Conservative Party actually conserved anything? And they couldn't think. Do you have an answer to that question? Can you think of when it did its job?
I think you have to go back to Lord Salisbury. I really do think you have to go that far. I really do. You certainly not post-war. There hasn't been a Conservative Party post-war, that is for sure. Before that, well, no. It's got to be Lord Salisbury, who's a great hero of mine, as you'll probably gather.
Yeah. Was that the 1880s or the 1890s? Yeah,
that was round about the 1890s. He was taken over by his son-in-law, I think it was, A.J. Balfour, which is the saying we will be familiar with, Bob's your uncle. He laid it on so that Arthur Balfour could get the premiership. And, of course, that's where the phrase comes, Bob's your uncle, which, of course, Bob was Lord Salisbury. But I love it. He's got some wonderful quotes. And it was interesting that I was going to give a lecture to the Conservative Union of Conservatives, the Conservative Association at Cambridge University last year. And I was banned by the faculty because I was too radical. And the lecture was going to be, would you believe, on the administration of Lord Salisbury. Ha! How radical am I? Aren't I a nasty man? Dear, oh dear, ban me. The faculty of Robinson College, Cambridge. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, it's amazing that, we could talk about the deplatforming, this craze, because it does seem to affect, I mean, that, like, you would think that an august British institution like Oxford University would be the last place to ban a conservative, but actually it does happen. You'd also expect them, in fact, they even, hope not hate, the guy who runs Hope Not, he got banned from, I think from Oxford, some organization there for being, it wasn't sufficiently progressive. That's amazing. And then I think also Germaine Greer got banned for, she's not sufficiently progressive on the transgender issue. I think that was what got her banned. And I think I have a vague memory of the same thing happening to J.K. Rowling as well, but I don't quote me on that.
I did actually speak at the Oxford Union. I think it was probably 10 years ago now. Probably a bit less than 10 years, 8 years. And I was speaking at the Oxford Union, and it was a very popular speech. I got 200,000 views. It was recorded, obviously. I got 200,000 views. And I got a big cheer from the audience, who actually came out to hate me. But, of course, the thing is with Oxford undergraduates, you think they're all very clever, but they actually believe anything they read in the Daily Mail. They think they're above all that kind of thing, but they're not, actually. Your average Oxbridge undergraduate who takes an interest in politics is really, again, not very bright. The people who go to debating societies in the Cambridge Union and the Oxford Union aren't reflective very often in the university. I mean, I sponsored rugby union at Cambridge University for some years as a businessman. And, of course, the proper chaps aren't in the audience at the Cambridge Union. They're actually playing rugby or rugby training and then getting into the pub, getting completely pissed. They're my kind of people, but then they don't turn up to listen to me at the Cambridge Union. Why would they?
Yes, is it the sort of feminists and
but they don't represent anybody.
Well, they represent the chatterati, the Guardian reading class.
Nobody reads the Guardian. The Yorkshire Post has more readers than the Guardian.
Yes,
it's fake. It's all fake. The BBC is fake. If you had to subscribe to the BBC to keep it alive, it would be out of business. Who would pay for the BBC if you weren't sent to prison? If that's understandable, you're not going to prison now, would you like to subscribe voluntarily? They'd be out of business by Sunday.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about the Guardian, I believe, is at least one point, it was supported by the fact that it was like the in-house newspaper at the BBC. because it's I think something like 80% of the newspapers in the BBC building were copies of The Guardian. This is about 10 years.
Yes, they were, and they had to read them. Yeah. And they had to read them. I mean, which made them easy when I was being interviewed and I was on the sofa, or I was with Andrew Neil, or I was with any of these people when I was interviewed by the BBC. It made them so easy. I never, ever lost an interview, ever. Not because I'm clever. It's because they are so stupid and they don't do their homework. Yeah. You know, they are really, and they've got a teleprompter. You lean across and put your hand over the teleprompter, which I did once to one of them. He didn't know what to say. His head fell off.
Well, you see, that's the funny thing, that The Guardian is propped up by the BBC, but the BBC is propped up by, well, the license fee. And I think you're right that that's another thing we could talk about. Do you think the BBC is doomed, like the EU and like democracy?
Yes, it is doomed. The BBC is doomed, but not for the reason that a lot of people think. Boris will never get round to doing anything about it because Boris is a talker, not a doer. But what will happen is people will just, when it comes to lockdown, why would you pay your license fee?
Yes.
Nobody's going to knock on your door. Nobody's allowed to come into your house. So why would you pay?
Yeah.
So what's going to happen is gradually everybody will just, I stopped paying years ago, but I mean, most people will just not pay.
Yes.
And so there are 20, well, there are sort of 60 odd Freeview channels to watch. Why would anybody want the BBC? Nobody's watching it. Channel 5 news now gets more viewers than the BBC news.
That's incredible. But I mean, the BBC used to, I think there are a lot of people throughout the country who have nostalgia for the BBC of a certain era. Yeah, I like the 70s. I like 70s. Dramas that were made then. Some people like the 80s, some people like the 90s, they've got nostalgia for that era. But the BBC of today is just absolutely awful. And I don't really understand how anyone could have affection for it, or, you know, except for ideological reasons.
Well, exactly. I mean, and don't forget, the BBC have made some very good drama productions, but for years, decades probably, they've been outsourced. It isn't the BBC's own drama teams that put them together, but they're outsourced and bought in or subcontracted. So we wouldn't be, even if they were still producing them, we wouldn't be short of them. They'd still be there. They'd just go into the commercial domain. In fact, they would become better because in order to sell advertising space or in order to subscriptions, you have to have viewers and you have to have enthusiasm for the programs. That would have to come back. I mean, I speak, when I was at prep school, we used to listen to Round the Horn and Beyond Our Ken. Okay, it's radio, but never mind that. There was only radio in those days. We never missed it. I mean, we never missed it. And I still listen today, roaring with laughter. Very, very funny. Fantastic programs. But those days have gone. They went a long time ago. They went a long time ago. And the salaries, of course, use a moral dimension. You've got Gary Lineker on £1.7 million a year. And there's a lot, whole raft of them on these kind of salaries. And they're taking £150 off old age pensioners down the road here in Pontefract. Where's your moral dynamic?
Yes, it's grotesque. The amounts of money that these people are paid now for, and they're not even that I mean, Gary Lineker simply is not that good a presenter. He's simply not. I cannot believe that he's worth that kind of money, that they couldn't get someone equally entertaining.
Nobody is worth that kind of. We should have a cap. Nobody at the BBC should be paid more than £100,000 a year. Not one single man jack of them.
All right. Yeah, it just seems to be, a moribund institution. And I really hope that it gets abolished. But
it won't be abolished. It will just wither on the vine.
Right, okay. All right, well, let's go to the final topic, which would be COVID, the lockdown, and the Great Reset, because that's obviously, I think people will very much want to hear your views on that. We've alluded to it several times throughout the discussion. I guess this relates to, well, to me, in my view, it relates to globalism and this push for a much, much more interconnected world, cashless society, and so on. there are many ways into this topic. Not many ways out of the topic, come to think of it. But what would you say has happened this year? Do you believe that it's, well, do you believe that it's a real virus? Do you believe that it's fake? Do you believe that it's the seasonal flu? Do you believe that it's been exaggerated? Take it away, please.
Well, I only can deal in the facts. As being a research economist by profession and an ex-chief executive of a life insurance company some years ago, I was used to assessing risk. Mortality risk was all part of it. I had an actuarial team working for me, but generally speaking, sooner or later you have to take a view. So we need to know exactly what are the facts. So the facts that I'm using, and my website drills right down. It will give all the references. So I'm not going to give any references on this conversation because it's all on my website and you can find it in depth, independent and government. So what do we know? What do we know? We know from the government's own statistics that only 1,700 people who were previously healthy have died of this virus, if virus it be. So that's 1,700. We know that under 65, barely 300 people have died if they were healthy. And we also know that healthy is a funny thing. That means they may not register of ill health in some way, but they could be 22 stone and all sorts of other things. But actually, there's no medical record. Or they could be vitamin D deficient, or there's other things here. So it's a so-called pandemic, which isn't killing anybody. Now, it will take away old people with comorbidity. If you are already old and frail and ill, and you get COVID, it'll whisk you away. What else do we know? We know that the statistics are fake. We know, do we not, that if you go into hospital and are tested positive and you die in hospital within 28 days, COVID will appear on your death certificate because they've got rid of the protocols for death certificates. So my oldest friend died 2 weeks ago of pancreatic cancer. He was only in hospital for his final 4 days. It was Farnborough Hospital and he was tested positive for COVID. It was on his death certificate. And this is happening all over the country, and we know it is because there's a financial remuneration for a hospital for a COVID death. It's an internal assessment, and I've been trying for weeks to get to the bottom of that, but I can't. But I know it to be the case, but I don't know just how much, because I've got a lot of friends who are doctors, surgeons, nurses, and radiologists who are too frightened to speak out. Again, it's all on my website. Their statements are on my website, but their names are protected. So we know that what we're dealing with here, what else do we know? We know that there's been no more deaths this year, average deaths this year than in the last 5 years. So we know the numbers don't stack up, and yet we're closing down the entire country's economy. We're driving a coach and horses through public, the principles of English law. We've abandoned the 1688 Bill of Rights. We've politicized the police force. We're doing all sorts of things which are quite illegal under our own constitution and law for our own benefit. We're being protected. We're being shielded by being locked down. And it was as the retired chief of the Supreme Court said the other day, well, we could be protected if they sedated us, locked us in a box and put us under the stairs. They would protect us. Do we want to go down that route? So what we need to do is we need for mainstream media to actually ask ministers, why are we counting infections and not deaths? Counting infections is meaningless. It's like trying to win the cup final on attempts at goal, shooting for goal instead of goals. It's meaningless. You can't win the cup final because you had a shot at goal more time than the other side did, but they actually scored more goals. It's meaningless. You might as well test for athlete's foot or dandruff. It doesn't make any sense. It's a waste of time. So we know all this, don't we? We know lockdown doesn't work. We tried lockdown for months. We didn't wear masks. We didn't need masks. We were told time and time again, and are still being told by virologists, that masks don't work. Now we all have to wear masks. As a sign of subservience, is it perhaps? Or is it really going to stop us getting COVID? So we're locking down again. Wales has locked down even more brutally than anywhere else. So what do we know from a factual perspective here? We know masks don't work. We know lockdown doesn't work. We know social distancing doesn't work. How could it? It's an aerosol virus. It travels in the air. So standing 6 feet away from somebody is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, ridiculous, as any senior international virologist across the country will tell you. And they're all on my website. You've just got to press the number and listen to real people, not Patrick Vallance or Chris Whitty or Matt Hancock. dear, oh dear. I'm talking about real scientists, real people. They're on my website. So what's the next stage? Do we think there's a conspiracy to get global reset to lock us all down under a technocracy? I don't know. What I'm telling you is there is no statistical data-driven support or evidence for the government doing what it's doing today. There is none. There's none. And we have a failure of Her Majesty's opposition. Where are the Labour Party? Where's the Labour Party front bench? And where's MSM? There's only Peter Hitchens who's actually challenging it. There's only one journalist for all the newspapers and all the television who's actually saying it's rubbish. Only one. So it is it's a deep state conspiracy of some sort.
So, yeah, why do you think that is, that only one journal? I mean, that is incredible. And the obvious thing that a supporter of it would say is, well, there's this consensus because the evidence is just so overwhelming and it's obviously the case. And anyone who disagrees with these things is just being irrational or just being difficult. Well, I can easily, and I've heard that said.
I've heard it said about climate change, the climate change debate. the science is settled. As Kipling said, it's never settled until it's settled right. If the evidence is so overwhelming, why can't we have an open debate about coronavirus? And why can't we have an open debate about climate change and its causes? What's wrong with having a... If it's so overwhelming, if it's such a no-brainer, why is everybody frightened of having an open debate? Like we had an open debate on Brexit. We have one side giving its case and the other side giving its case. What's wrong with that in a free society? Trying to tell people that the science is settled, the historical view of this I always take, especially on climate, is the view of the Catholic Church, Dr. Nicholas Copernicus and Galileo. It didn't suit groupthink within the Catholic Church. So we had to stick with the fact that the sun went round the earth for decades after everybody knew. We know that climate change is happening, but it's only happening very modestly. We know that in the last 20 years, the apocalyptic, the crazy boil to death that is pervaded. And who's pervading it? Not science, not international top independent scientists. The Prince of Wales, who's crackers, and this funny little Swedish bird whose name I forget, the little pixie, who's slightly retarded. I mean, what's it all about? Why can't we have some scientists? Where's Professor Plimer? Where's Professor Limbaugh? Where's all the top brains debating this? I don't want a lunatic British royal and a little bird from Sweden telling me how the world's going to boil.
Yeah. It is part of the danger of... When people say, well, it's the science is settled. This is the danger of entering a scientistic sort of age, because the fact is most people... the vast majority of people don't understand science. So when you say that something is dependent on the science, basically you're saying it's dependent on things that you cannot understand. So just do as you're told. And I think it's the same now with COVID.
This is exactly right, because the entire civil service read art subjects. Politicians read art subjects. I don't think the last prime minister to read science was Maggie Thatcher, who was a chemist. But Boris is a classicist, and most of them read PPE, which is a drinker's gourd, as we all know.
They
don't know anything about anything. PPE.
It's politics, philosophy and economics, isn't it?
That's right. It's just a way of getting on the piss at Oxford. It's not real. It's a joke. Everybody knows it's a joke. You go to Oxford, it's a joke. Everyone knows it's a joke. It's a bit like going to Durham, and if somebody's reading geography. They're pissheads. Nothing wrong with that. It's a way of avoiding serious subjects. So somebody comes along and says, oh, it's a science. Boris shits himself because he doesn't understand, doesn't want to understand science, and he doesn't understand numbers.
What does he understand? I mean, you said earlier that he's a buffoon.
Well, the problem with Boris, he was like David Cameron before him. Boris and David Cameron, who are both of the same kidney, they are both Oxford. They are both playboys in their own way. They wanted to become prime minister. Their ambition was want to be prime minister, and they become prime minister. But unlike me, if I wanted to be prime minister, and by good, I couldn't make a worse job of it than these comedians are doing, I would want to be a prime minister in order to change things, to make things happen. Boris and David Cameron just want to be in number 10 to be there. They just want to be there. I'm prime minister. Aren't I a clever boy? Where's my private jet to the next conference? I mean, Cameron didn't have an original thought in his head, but he had a pushy wife. Boris hasn't had an original thought in his head, but he's got a pushy fiance. All the strings being pulled are by greeny girls. So if Boris doesn't go down the green route, no nookie.
Right. Yeah, I guess that explains his position this year and his steadfast refusal to change course. It's a very strange situation. I mean, it feels like this is a country that used to be a great country and, you know, ruled a quarter of the globe and so on. And we, you know, it's a cliche to say that we're lions led by donkeys, or whatever. But I mean, it does feel like we're living in a circus, being led by clowns and incompetence. I mean, Matt Hancock, it would be difficult to conjure a man who would inspire less confidence than Matt Hancock. And yet he is the one supposedly entrusted with the nation's health. I mean, it's just farcical.
I worked for a very snooty investment bank in the city. He wouldn't get in to clean the cars. He wouldn't have got into our organisation to clean the bloody cars. It doesn't help that he looks like a child molester as well, which is less than helpful. But I mean, he couldn't possibly inspire confidence, could he? He doesn't inspire confidence.
Yeah, he doesn't. And did you see the clip of him pretending to cry when they got the vaccine out?
I know. Now, if he wants to pretend to cry, he needs to go to Spencer Tracy. Get some old clips of Spencer Tracy, who could actually produce real tears on demand. No, Hancock was pathetic.
Yeah, it was nonsense. Well, before we end, there are a couple of questions for you. Okay, someone says, Godfrey, I enjoyed your speech on property rights and the benefits of free market capitalism. I can easily say that your speech on this matter completely transformed me from a Marxist-Leninist to a capitalist. So that's you've got a fan there.
Well, I'm certainly grateful. I just wish I could remember the speech.
Okay. I'll see if I can link it below later. Someone's asking thoughts on Nigel Farage. I feel like his speeches to the European Parliament are some of the most moving speeches of our time.
Yes, he's a tremendous performer. Nigel is a great performer, and he was in his element, as indeed I was myself, because it was a wonderful forum for chaps like me and Nigel to vent our spleen, as it were. So, yes, he's done a wonderful job in contributing to the fact that we got a referendum in the first place. And if it hadn't been for UKIP, there would have been no referendum to win. And we did win it. One slight caveat, which I have mentioned to Nigel on one or two occasions, it would be nice, perhaps, if he stopped implying he was the only person that got it. The real heroes of UKIP were the people out on the streets in all weathers when the case looked hopeless, delivering leaflets, standing in the market square. It wasn't because Nigel appeared on Question Time. Nobody watches bloody Question Time in Yorkshire, especially the worker. We got 4 million votes. 4 million votes up here in UKIP in 2014, mainly working class votes from Labour. They don't watch it because they're patriots and they were given leaflets and they were persuaded by their neighbours knocking on their door. All credit to them. Credit to Nigel, certainly. But Nigel, if you're watching this clip, it'd be a nice occasion if you remembered some of those foot soldiers.
All right. Someone says, thank you. Thank you, Woz, for inviting this fine gentleman onto Millennial. May the gods bless Mr. Bloom with a long and happy life. There you go.
That's most kind, and I thank you for those good wishes.
All right. Okay, well, let's end it there. This has been a really fun and interesting and fast-paced discussion interview. So thanks very much. It's been really good. I know that the audience have loved it. So thanks for doing this.
Thank you for inviting me.
Excellent. Well, okay, I'll be in touch with the video and you can publish it on your own channel if you want to do that. But in the meantime, Godfrey Bloom, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2020. And everyone else, I'll see you in an hour from now with another interview.
Thank you.
Okay. Hope you all enjoyed this. Bye for now.